Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. In my excitement, I'm making mistakes even as I make my opening statement, because by the blessings of our beloved Bhagwan, we are beginning a new journey today, a new theme, a new concept. It is going to be wonderful, it's going to be exciting, it is definitely going to be enlightening. And all this is because it concerns something to do directly with our beloved Swami. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that four kinds of devotees come to him: Artha, Artharthi, Jignyasu and Jnani. If we have to see it in terms of numbers, that was the classification that Bhagavan Krishna gave in terms of quality. But in terms of numbers, I think the first two categories, Artha and Artharthi, dominate the landscape. All of us, well, that would be wrong. Most of us have come to Swami because of some problems that we have faced, or because we wanted some kind of a medical healing, some kind of a relationship repair, some kind of a progress, growth in the world, to fulfill some dissatisfaction that doesn't seem to leave us. And therefore, in those early days when we are given a chance to speak with Bhagwan, usually we will directly ask for what we are seeking. Swami, so and so of mine is suffering from this, please heal him or heal her. Swami, such and such a thing is going to happen, my career is in ruins, please help me. In fact, when I look at my own family, my uncle came to Swami with that prayer. The only thing that he wanted to seek from Swami when he came was, Swami, I am getting transferred to Calcutta, please cancel it. So, different people have different problems, but almost all of them can be bunched under these two headings, Artha and Artharthi. It is only as we mature as devotees, we realize that Swami is the Kalpa Vriksha, Swami is the Kamadenu, the wish-fulfilling tree or the desire-fulfilling cow that can grant us the greatest treasures, and it should not be wasted for trivial things in life. That is when possibly we have started our journey towards wisdom, our journey towards becoming jnanis. We all become jignyasus. We would like to ask questions from Swami, seek answers for those things that we cannot find easily. Swami, how do we develop faith? Swami, why does good happen to bad people? All these kinds of questions arise. They have no immediate monetary or material interest or benefit to us. But still, we would seek this from Swami because nobody other than Swami can give this. And that is the Jignyasu stage. The new program, the new serial that we are about to begin on our afternoon satsang, which we will be doing every alternate fortnight, is regarding this Jignyasu stage, where we ask all our doubts from Bhagwan during our journey towards becoming jnanis or wisdom. Whether we become jnanis or not, jnana definitely flows from Bhagwan, and that is why we are very excited, because over the next several fortnights when we take up this special segment, we will be diving into that flow of jnana that Bhagwan has showered on us. But before I, you know, lose myself and in this excitement and go further ahead, I would like to begin by offering humble pranams at the lotus feet of beloved Bhagwan and welcoming Prem. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and very aptly introduced. Because as you said, one of the graduation that has to happen in all of our lives is going from the needs of the body, the immediate needs of those who are near and dear to us, to a need which is actually beyond the barricade of death, if you could put it like that. Because what I have as a need for my body today, it could be momentary. It could be a poverty which I want alleviation from. It could be a disease I want cure from. Or it could be some relative or friend who needs help. But all of these will change. But there is one quest which is eternal, which comes with us from birth to birth. And as Swami would say, that till you answer those questions, till you find solutions for those problems, you will never rest in peace. So at some point, we'll have to turn to these questions which we will repeatedly ask. You know, it's not questions that you ask once, you get an answer, and then you settle down. These are questions that you'll keep repeatedly asking, and even as we try to implement the answers in our life, we will get further questions, and those questions have to be asked. But for that, as Swami would say, you have to put this need above all your other needs. To some extent, that's why all of these things that Swami speaks about, sealing on desires, to have control over our senses, to have, you know, give lesser and lesser regard to the body as much as possible, all this leads to this state where this need of answering these eternal questions become a priority compared to the needs of the body. And that doesn't mean that Swami is going to ignore the needs of the body or is going to say that you dare not come and ask me for such things anymore. Out of Swami's love, Swami is going to take care of that also. But at some point, this need should become more and this craving should become intense. And that is why at some point, we need to look at Swami as a person who has the absolute answers to give. And as you said, we're going to start a series, and this series is based on one such devotee who had a brilliant conversation with Swami over many, many years. In fact, close to a decade or more. And probably, I'll just read out few lines that this devotee writes in his book, why the conversation that this devotee has had with Swami is important. And probably that's an introduction to the content we'll be discussing over the next few weeks. It's actually the foreword to the book. We've not yet named the book. We'll do that in a short while. The devotee writes, the questions and answers included herein date from January 1968 through February 1978. And then he says how the interviews were recorded and all that. And this is the most interesting paragraph. He says, the questions asked make no pretense of being profound. The answers, however, come directly from truth and may illumine the understanding of the greatest scholar or the most practiced yogi. Devotees are aware how infrequent and difficult to secure our conversations with Bhagwan. For this reason, a decision was made to publish the notebook. And that is why this is a very important, and it's a repository of wisdom that we are going to take a dive into.
Well, for those who have seen the subject or topic line in our website for Afternoon Satsang, it will not be a surprise. But for the others, the theme that we are picking up is this book, Conversations with Swami, Conversations with Sai, by Dr. John Hislop. Because as we, you know, cursorily turned a few pages of this book, each page had some stunning revelation for us. It was so amazing, it was so wonderful. And then came the idea that Ramkatha Rasavahini is over, Bhagavata Vahini is completed in the satsang, what do we take up next? And it was Swami's gift to us that Dr. John Hislop's book came our way. This is also another Vahini. Possibly we can call it the Sai Vaya Hislop Vahini, because though the book is by Dr. John Hislop, as he himself says in the foreword, everything is Swami's word. And when they say it is Swami's word, it is not words derived during a meditation, during a trance, or as an intuitive answer from deep within. These are direct words of the avatar spoken. In fact, Dr. Hislop says that many of these conversations were tape recorded. It's only in the later years when, you know, Swami would have these conversations here and there without any constraint of time, place. That is when Dr. Hislop was forced to make notes on a notepad, which he would return to his room and cherish and treasure and make elaborate notes on. So it's only the latter part of the conversations that have been noted on notepad and reproduced for our benefit, for the benefit of humanity. But rest of his conversations have been audio taped, and there are transcripts with transcripts that Dr. John Hislop has produced. And though I have not gone through all of it, I've just gone through a little bit here and there, that much was enough. That menu card was enough to make my mouth water in anticipation, excitement and temptation.
And even as you were saying that, those of our listeners who have been listening to our programs from the morning, they would have heard the previous segment, which was about Mrs. Ratanlal, another great devotee. Many of these initial conversations actually happened in her house or her cottage in Vrindavan. And she would fondly recall how Swami would permit his love to tape all of those things, because it's not a thing which Swami would allow everybody. As we all know, you know, very few people were given the opportunity to tape the interview. We still have some of those interviews which Swami gave to Western devotees, which were, you know, Swami permitted to be taped. And talking about tape recording a conversation with Swami, I think it is Mrs. Geeta Mohan Ramu narrates a very beautiful incident where there was an occasion where I don't recall the details properly, but they were traveling with Swami every day for some purpose. And during that car drive, Swami used to tell a lot of stories and some stories from the Ramayana, Mahabharata, some of his old devotees' experiences and all that. And so there were two children in that car every day, and they felt that, you know, we are hearing all this, but the others are missing out. So it would be nice if we can tape this whole conversation. So they literally smuggled a tape recorder inside the car, and they think that we'll tape the whole conversation. And, you know, they practice the whole thing, how they'll, you know, start the thing. And then they said, what do we do when we, you know, click the play? There'll be a sound. Swami will ask what it is. And even more than that that sound, you could probably do the play before you enter the car. But there'll be a side chain of the cassette, where there'll be a snap and the, you know, the stop button pops up on its own.
The tape will get ejected out and you'll turn it around. Yes.
So when that sound comes, what to do? And so they thought of a reason they could give Swami, if Swami asked what's that sound and all of that. And everything was done. And they managed to tape, you know, two sides of a cassette. And at the end of it, as Swami was getting down, Swami had a very mischievous smile on his face, looked at these two children who were up to this mischief. And Swami told them, "Yemi raledu." And walked away.
Yemi raledu means nothing has come.
And they were wondering, what is Swami saying? So after that, they went back home and they heard, and all that they had was two sides of empty tape. Nothing was taped except for towards the end of side B were the words, "Yemi raledu."
You know, this reminds me of a even more bizarre kind of incident. I think it's recorded in either the Satyam Shivam Sundaram, or I think most probably in Loving God by Professor N. Kasturi. When Swami had visited Kerala, that is, I think he had made only one visit or two visits, late 1960s and one later on. So during the visit, he gave several discourses, and those discourses have been taped and they have been transcribed. They are available to us as Satya Sai Speaks. In one of the discourses, Swami promised the people that he would be coming, and some of the office bearers there were thrilled because they now had it on tape, Swami's word and Swami's promise. They felt that in case in future Swami refuses to come, because it had taken a lot of convincing to take Swami to Kerala that time, so they felt that in future if there is a problem, they can just play back this discourse of Bhagwan and hold him by his word, you know. You usually hold a person with a pistol, but here they decided to hold him by his own word. Swami, you have said it, so you have to come. When they actually approached Swami, Swami said, no, I didn't say any such thing. And they started playing the discourse. And unlike in the case that you mentioned, here the discourse was there. But exactly that area where that statement had been made, that was possibly the tape change area, or I don't know what, but that part was missing. Even to this day, in the Satya Sai Speaks also, that discourse doesn't carry those words where Swami is telling, "I will come to Kerala." So, you know, many times all this happens because we are fooled by what we see of Swami, what our senses perceive of Swami. Swami says, "You are not one but three, the one you think you are, the one others think you are, and the one that you really are." We always go by what we think Swami is and what others think of Swami. That's what it is, because that's what our senses and mind can comprehend. He is beyond the mind, and to the one who has created this universe so spontaneously, to the one who protects, nurtures and takes care of this entire universe again so spontaneously, and to the one who completely destroys the entire world, you know, what we call as pralaya. It is a complete restart, a reset button. Again, it happens so spontaneously. For such a, I can't even say person, such a being, such a whatever, for such a power, what is a big thing about, you know, erasing a few lines of tape? But we will be able to think like this when we always remain fixed and rooted in who Swami is. And I must say that as we read through the book of Dr. John Hislop, to his credit, it definitely is with this kind of a humility and supplication that he approaches Swami. There is a sincerity and there is a seriousness for him to record and cherish each and every word that Swami is speaking. And that is why I feel it is in order that we offer our gratitude to Dr. John Hislop also for being such a wonderful instrument of Swami in capturing another Vahini, which is almost like a Prashnottara Vahini, extension, part two, for the benefit of entire mankind.
And absolutely. I mean, the reason why I was telling about that tape not recording is, many times you would feel that when you're sitting in Swami's presence. I don't know if others would concur with this opinion, but you would feel that Swami is holding himself back. You'd feel that Swami could probably give much more of himself, much more of what he is here to give, but he's holding himself back. And the only thing which, when that thought would occur to me when I'm sitting in front of Swami, is we are not prepared to receive as much from Swami. That used to come so strongly that, you know, literally how the vision was given to Arjuna and Arjuna could not take it. Because in his glory, if it is shown in all his glory, if he comes in front of us, we do not have the ability to absorb that much energy. And that is why I think even when it comes to Swami's wisdom, Swami is literally sometimes given it in a drizzle, in a trickle it has come, because that is our capacity to accept it. And whatever he has given is so precious, because Swami felt that this much is, you know, more than enough. If you're able to follow this much, you'll be somewhere else. And when Swami did not permit so much of these conversations to be taped, and that is why whatever Swami has left, be it Swami's discourses, Swami's Vahinis, or books like this, or other books, I think there are a couple of other devotees who have made it a part of their book, the conversations they had with Swami in the interviews. I think all of these are very, very precious material for us to look at. And especially a personality like John Hislop becomes a very important a questioner in the modern context, because he comes from the Western thought. You know, he comes... He's a Westerner. He's brought up in, he primarily has a Western education, but not completely Westernized too, because he's always been drawn to the Oriental. We'll see that, how his life, you know, very gradually turned to Swami, but he was prepared with that. There was a dash of the Oriental wisdom which was always there in his life. So clearly he's a person who I think typifies most of us, who have been a product of modern Westernized education, but it's, at the same time, there is that basic philosophical quest in each one of us. But we are literally, you know, torn between the two worlds. And these are questions which are coming from such a mind, and the answers which Swami gives are relevant for us even today, because we are typically there. We are typically there. We want to accept what Swami is saying, but we want to understand what Swami is saying also, not simply, you know, accept it without giving answers to our reasoning mind too.
The amazing thing about Hislop is, how shall I put it? See, being a student of chemistry, I'm sure you also know this term called leveling effect. The leveling effect is seen when we are trying to compare the strengths of different chemicals. For example, if we take acids. So these acids, their strengths are measured in water usually. So therefore, their strengths are all relative to water. In fact, water also behaves as a weak acid in certain cases. Therefore, taking water as the base, you compare different acids. In water, when you do this, you observe this thing called leveling effect, wherein some of the strongest acids that we know, 3-4 of them, all of them appear to be equally strong. You cannot say who is stronger, who is weaker. And that's not because all of them are equally strong. That's because of the limitation of water. If I have a capacity to hold only 100, then I can judge which bag has greater capacity up to bags which have a capacity of 100. Now, if you give me a bag with capacity 200 and a bag with capacity 300, for me both are full strong, full, because my capacity is only 100. So in chemistry, what they usually do is they compare the strengths of acids with a mild acid or a stronger acid compared to water. That is when you are able to separate out and actually get a ranking order for the strongest acid, the second, third, a ranking is developed. I also feel in the spiritual journey in our lives, we are like that water. We are like very, very basic. That is why anything that, you know, anything that we find inspirational, anything we find amazing, we get thrilled. We come across statements such as, okay, Swami said this, but you know what? This is amazing. We compare Swami with the other kind of gurus or people who have actually had an ascent. You know, people who are born normal human beings, they do education, they study, they get their doctorate, they get pulled to spirituality, they study, they grow, evolve, and possibly by the end of their lives, they have become gurus. It's an ascent for them. But in Swami's case, it's a descent. But since we don't have that capacity, for us, it looks like the same. Yeah, it is the same. You know, what Swami says, what so-and-so says, what X, Y, Z says, they're all the same. It is, yes, in that sense, we are true. It is all the same for us. That is because of our level of evolution. But as we evolve, we will see the difference. And when we actually search even the internet, or if we have actually visited different gurus, there have been so many modern day gurus who have, you know, who have told their disciples that when it comes to Satya Sai Baba, he is at a different level. You know, don't even compare us to Satya Sai Baba. There have been, I would not like to name those gurus, but there have been many such gurus who have actually told, who have huge followings, but when it comes to Satya Sai Baba, they say no. In fact, one guru who is very, very popular in the world nowadays, he in fact said that, I can give you theoretical answers for your questions, but if you want that experience, that is whom you have to go to, pointing to Satya Sai Baba. So, you know, I feel this is that leveling effect that is seen among normal humanity. And why I'm telling all this is because Hislop was not like that. He was not like water. We will be going briefly through his life to see he has actually been part of different things. He has been part of the church. He has gone through yoga. He has gone through meditation, transcendental meditation, different things he has done. And having done all that, he arrived to Swami. And his first impression of Swami, oh my God, it is there in the first chapter of the book, My Baba and I, and it just takes our breath away. But I think all of that we'll hold for after this break. Dear listeners, don't go away anywhere. After this little break, we will go in briefly into the life and experiences of John Hislop to understand why possibly Swami gave him this opportunity to have the conversations, and why possibly his understanding and his questions make so much more meaning for all of us, irrespective of the stage of life we are in. But all that after the break. See you very soon.
I look out, what do I see? It looks like you, it looks like me. The world is full of many things, big and small, short and tall. Beyond space, beyond time, is where we live, eternal no time. Such a sigh is here to say, love will take us all the way. Look at you, you radiate love and peace, ain't it great? There's only heaven, there is no hell. Love everyone and all will go well. Help everyone that you can, it will take you to the promised land. Such a sigh is
Satya Sai is here to say, love will take us all the way. Big and small, short and tall, light and heavy, we are all. Yellow, black, white, red and brown, only one heart can be found. Make this world a place of peace, where only joy is what you'll meet. Satya Sai is here to say, love will take us all the way. Love is our real name, when we know we win the game. Satya Sai is here to say, love will take us all the way. Satya Sai is here to say, love will take us all the way, all the way, all the way.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are beginning this beautiful book, Conversations with Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba by John Hislop. And talking of Hislop, and you know, he writes in his other book, of course, My Baba and I, where about his first, how they first came to Swami. And that's very interesting. Interesting thing is, you know, he makes one statement in that, one observation, where what was that one thing which made them take this decision of coming and seeing Swami. And he talks of, We mentioned that this entire book of conversations is between January 1968 to February 1978. So it's in January 1968 they first come to know of Swami. They hear of Swami from a friend of theirs, a lady who has come back from Prashant Nilayam. And she says that, you know, this is what happened, and she has vibhuti which Swami has given her. She has a ring or a locket which Swami has given her. She's telling all of these fascinating stories. They're listening to all of this with a lot of interest, but Hislop says that there's one thing that she said which was a clincher. And that's the beautiful thing. He says that this lady told them that there was something that happened to me in Swami's presence. My character changed when I was in Swami's presence, and it changed in a way that it did not revert back when I came away from Swami's presence. And this struck Hislop and his wife so deeply. He said, can there be a human person in whose mere presence a human heart can get transformed? And, you know, he says that we heard this story on a Monday, and before the end of the week, we were already flying to India. And, I mean, it really shows what, how burning that quest was, and how, what they were looking for. It was not looking for miracles. It was not looking for some, fantastic stories, but looking for transformation, and somebody who can effect transformation merely by one's presence.
And, you know, as you rightly said, that kind of an urgency came because of a reason. And that reason is seen from Hislop's early life, you know. He is born possibly, I think, in 1907 or 1908. That is when he is born. And from childhood, he has a spiritual bent of mind. He is part of the Episcopal Church. But in the church, as he hears them proclaim the truth, he has a feeling within him. He says that it's a gnawing feeling that he can't let go of. And the feeling is, the people of the Episcopal Church speak the truth, but they do not know the truth. And somewhere in this world, there must be a person who knows the truth, and not just speaks about it. That was a feeling that he had. And throughout his childhood, somehow he felt drawn towards even service. He felt that the only thing of value in this world is service. And therefore, as he plunged himself into service, he came across the Theosophical Society, founded by Dr. Annie Besant. And in fact, for 2 years, in 1925 and 1926, he was a person who took care of all the Theosophical Society's activities in America and Mexico.
Oh.
And he personally has met Dr. Annie Besant and Jiddu Krishnamurti multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And so much was his eagerness and enthusiasm towards spirituality that he actually discontinued after high school so that he can involve himself in this. And he was there, you know, plowing the fields, growing vegetables, cutting vegetables, doing all kinds of karma yoga. But then he didn't feel that satisfaction. And that is why he went back to education, began to pursue his education. At the same time, decided to try out yoga. And you know, it's like when he decides to do something, he goes all out and meets the people who are at top at it. Because as he decides to do yoga, he meets Iyengar and he also meets Paramahamsa Yogananda, the one who has popularized Kriya Yoga throughout the world.
Right.
And he starts his practice of yoga alongside his academics. But then, you know, again, he is not having satisfaction, and after trying out for some time, he feels that he is not cut out for yoga. That is when he gets to know of Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, who is very, very famous for two things. One is his transcendental meditation, but more than that, his popularity soared because he got as his disciples the Beatles. The Beatles became a disciple of Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, and they, in fact, even sang a few songs on him and his teachings. So, huge following. In fact, when I checked up on Wikipedia, even to this day, Maharshi Mahesh Yogi's institutions and what he has left behind legacy thrives, especially in the United States and Mexico. Now, he was introduced to Mahesh Yogi, and by then he had become a doctorate, and he was well endowed also. In fact, he, Dr. John Hislop, is responsible for starting Maharshi Mahesh Yogi's ashrams in India.
Oh,
okay. Amazing. And that's a detailed experience that he has shared in the book. I will not be going into it, but at Rishikesh, he set up the ashram bang opposite to the ashram of Swami Shivananda. Mm-hmm. Where it still exists to this day. And therefore, he also met Swami Shivananda. You know, when I was going through all this, he has met a galaxy of the who's who of the spiritual world of those times, of his times. Annie Besant, Jiddu Krishnamurti, Iyengar, Paramahamsa Yogananda, Mahesh Yogi, Swami Shivananda. And that was not all. He practiced, he became a teacher in the transcendental meditation. And he says that one day, some deep-rooted thought from within came that though he was an advanced teacher, he is unable to experience that pure bliss, causeless bliss that people speak about. You know, he said, what is the use of all this? I am not getting ananda. That very day he resigned. He has built up this entire organization. I mean, all these show that man's thirst for the absolute and nothing less than that. Because he is the one who has put in his time, his energy and his own money in building up this organization. And when the organization is nearing its peak, one fine day, he just goes and resigns from all the posts that he's holding. He's an organization builder. He resigns from all his posts and he says that for personal reasons, I have to leave. And he just leaves. After that, he travels to India because somehow he has that gut feeling that India is the place where I'm going to get my salvation. He meets the Rinpoche. He meets the Dalai Lama. You know, it is amazing. And then he finally returns back to Mexico and he's staying there. That is when, as you said, this happens. And so you see, there is something amazing. There is a long history and he is seeking desperately for a transformation from within, which he is not getting, whether he is practicing his Christian Episcopal Church or he is practicing yoga, he is practicing transcendental meditation, he is practicing the principles of Buddhism, he is not getting it. And here comes a person who says that, you know, just being in the presence of this being, I have undergone a transformation of character. No wonder that even in the 1960s, when it was not like going online and booking a ticket, even in such days, within a week, he found himself in India. And his experience with Swami, his first experience, it's captured in the first chapter of the book. I think it is something worth reading because it is so amazing. You see the poet in Dr. John Hislop.
You know, there's a analogy which Swami would often give, you know, when the cow gives milk, the milk is used by many, many people apart from the calf. But the cow actually produces that milk when it sees the calf. That's what Swami would say. When it sees the calf, it automatically, I mean, it does not have to command the body to produce milk. And Swami would say that the sight of the calf itself makes the, you know, of course, the biological process is there. But Swami would say that the presence of the calf is what makes this cow produce that milk. And I recall when we were in Vrindavan, this is the time when all the new students come and join the campuses, you know, 31st of May and the 1st of June. And I recall the first few days in Vrindavan when we had joined, and Swami used to come and give us three sessions. But Swami would not speak so often. Once in a while Swami would speak, but invariably it would be, a couple of teachers would give some talks. But Swami would sit there and have very casual conversations. And I recall one day Swami spoke. Mm-hmm. Swami gave a discourse and we were all very happy, oh, Swami is giving a discourse today. And at the end of that discourse, Swami said, you know, today is a Sunday. And he pointed to a couple of boys in the audience. We didn't know any of them then. Actually, there were some boys who were working in the trust in Prashanthi Nilayam here.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the boys were working in the hospital and the central trust. And they would come during the weekends to have Swami's darshan. And they would be in the thrai session in the evening. And Swami pointed to some of those boys and Swami said, I saw some of these boys in the audience, so I felt like speaking today. And Swami said, because I know that they really crave and value Swami's words. You know, as young students, when we heard that, you know, it was so revealing for us. Of course, we all benefited sitting there when Swami spoke. But for Swami to speak, you need somebody like that, some seeker who really values and inspires Swami to speak, if I could use that word in Swami's context, for Swami to, you know, come out with that wisdom.
You know, Prem, just last night, I had this wonderful dream.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I used to think that when any personal dream I get, invariably in the afternoon satsang that comes after that, mm-hmm. I narrate it. So this time I thought, no, I will make it a point. But as I narrate the dream, you will understand why I am narrating it. So in the dream, I was with Swami in the interview room and we were having a conversation, some personal things. Suddenly, Swami got up and he walked out of the interview room. And I actually am walking and I don't know, it is not that I am walking behind him, but I am standing at the door of the interview room and I can see everything that Swami is doing. Swami walked out. He spoke to nobody in particular, but he walked down to a distance near the gate and stood there for a while and came back into the interview room and he was like, okay, let's proceed with what we were discussing. So before proceeding with what we were discussing, I asked Swami, I said, Swami, why did you suddenly go there, you know? We were in the middle of an important discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So the way you went out, I thought something very important has come. But you just went there, you didn't speak to anybody also. For whose sake? Why did you go out? You know? Swami said, I went out for the sake of a devotee. I said, Swami, which is that devotee? Because you didn't speak to anybody. And then Swami said, you saw beyond outside the Gopuram gate, one devotee stood there and was praying. And I went to give him darshan. I said, Swami, you went out for the devotee at Gopuram gate. Yes, he had my darshan and he left. But what about everybody sitting in Kulwant Hall, Swami? Are they not craving? Are they not craving for your darshan? Swami said, yeah, they're craving for my darshan. But that is the devotee who has touched my heart and I have to grant him darshan. But as beneficiaries, everybody else got. I said, so Swami, everyone getting darshan is as beneficiaries? Swami said, yes, that is because of satsang. What satsang, Swami? They happened to be in Kulwant Hall when that noble devotee came there near the Gopuram gate.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, oh my God, Swami, that is satsang. Swami, then I would always love to be in satsang. How can I be in satsang? Swami said, you don't have to make efforts to be in satsang. If you have craving for Swami, it is enough. That craving for Swami will bring satsang to you. And that satsang will increase your craving. So much so that you will have Swami coming to you in your heart. And once you reach that state, you will not need any satsang. And then Swami said, satsangatve nisangatvam. You know, this was a major part of the dream that I had. But then I thought, you know, now when you said about the calf and, you know, I just felt like this is so relevant now that I had to tell. So it was so amazing. And Hislop, is one such calf, is one such devotee at the Gopuram gate, for whose sake Swami did so much, and we are all the people in Kulwanthal, we are all the humanity that drinks the cow milk and is enjoying and getting nourished by it.
And another conversation I recall is, I think there's a recording of that. You know, Swami is sitting in Kodaikanal and Swami is asking the students, you have any questions you can ask. And there's one student who asks a question. I mean, when I listened to the question, I thought the question was quite profound. I don't recall what it is now, but something of interest. You know, I would think that, yeah, that's a question even I would, you know, it would occur to me once in a while. So he was asking that question and Swami gave him an answer. Swami gave him an appropriate answer. I mean, who am I to judge that? But Swami gives him an answer. But then Swami says, just for the sake of asking questions, you ask. You know, it's not a question. It's something like a filler. You just want to fill time, you're asking. So I was thinking, why is Swami saying that? I thought it was a good question. And Swami has also taken it seriously and given an answer. But I think that is what it is, you know. A question which comes at the end of craving for knowing what the answer is completely different from, you know, we've also done that. You know, when we get an opportunity to sit with Swami, we try to have Swami for as long as possible by asking questions. That is what we try to do. But, you know, when you see the illustrious career of somebody who at the end of all this comes to Swami, he's not asking questions simply for the sake of asking questions. And he will not be satisfied with answers just because it is coming from Swami. You know, the answers must be really answering the questions that he's having. And he must be able to say that, yes, this is the ultimate answer that I'm getting, even from an intellectual standpoint. Not purely as a form of surrender, not purely as an expression of his devotion. So the questions that he's asking are really relevant and coming out of deep yearning, which again is something which Swami appreciates. And his acceptance of the answer is, you can be sure that these may be questions that he has posed to many of these illustrious personalities that he has met with. And if he says, Swami, this answer is really satisfying, then I think maybe even if we are not able to relate to the answer of Swami when we read it, I think that the answer is really relevant to the question. Because I think sometime back when we were doing a discussion, we made this very profound statement, because we made it, but it struck us more than, you know, anything else, where we said, a master is one who does not answer the questions. A master is one who answers you, right? The master is one who answers the questioner and not the question. And that is why some of these answers, many times when I go through conversations with Sai, at that point when I was reading, I would feel that, I don't know how this is a suitable answer for this question. But many years later, when you're reading the same thing, you say, this is the most appropriate answer. So that is why, even if we are doing the whole program and reading out all these questions, I think just like how we said for Ramakatha Raswaini or Bhagavata Vaini, where the individual has to go back and read these questions and answers for themselves, same is the thing with, I mean, the story for themselves, same is the thing with these questions and answers too. They can always, we should always go back to it, and we are sure to draw more and more wisdom out of it.
And even as Hislop asked Swami these questions and recorded those answers very sincerely and painstakingly, he actually progressed in multiple ways. You know, he got many, many experiences in Bhagwan's presence. He witnessed many miracles. It's amazing. And all of those he has recorded in another book called My Baba and I. So it was not like a separate journey. It is not like he came as an interrogator and asked questions for 10 years. He actually became one of the important people of the Sri Satya Sai organization.
Right.
He helped in the spread and actually the building and spread of the Satya Sai organization in America and Mexico, along with, I think, the
Mr.
Covens.
Crystal and Covens.
Yeah, the Covens and Crystals. Yeah. So he definitely has been one of the foundation is, of course, Swami, but one of the stalwart pillars of the Sri Satya Sai organizations. All that is there, but it would be very interesting to go through a few experiences of his life, because they are so beautiful. The experiences themselves, as always, have deep spiritual meaning. And we are able to understand the spiritual meaning because Hislop was a person like that, who always focused on the spiritual aspect of the things, because it was not simply a miracle for him. How many of us may have had miracles, and for us it is just a miracle which brings thrill to our heart. But in the case of Dr. John Hislop, he deeply goes into each miracle, and for each miracle he finds the spiritual meaning that it has for him. So it would be interesting to go through a few of his miracles, and we can start with the most popular and most famous one. And I think it would be best that we hear that experience in his own words. So here is Dr. John Hislop narrating the story of an amazing miracle in his own words.
So then the next year on Mahashivaratri, Swami said to me, he said, Hislop, you get a taxi and you be ready at 5 o'clock in the morning. And you take Kasturi in your car, and we're going someplace. We're going up to, and Kasturi will know where it is. That's what he didn't tell me, because he's afraid I would blab it to somebody. And Kasturi will know where it is. He'll tell you. And so we got in the car, and Kasturi said, well, keep on driving. We're going to go up to the Mysore forest. And as we went up to the Mysore forest, there was a constant procession of cars coming towards us, that is, people from all around coming to Vrindavan, hoping that the Mahashivaratri would be celebrated in Vrindavan. And you know, everybody knows Kasturi, but all the people in the cars coming knew Kasturi. They'd seen him for years. And yet, not one of those cars recognized Kasturi riding in our taxi. Complete blank. Complete disguise of some sort in front of them. They couldn't even see him. So we got up to the Mysore forest. And the first thing we did, there was some college students too. Swami had sent up a bus, maybe a dozen or so college students. And the first thing we did was to ride around through the forest, trying to find the wild elephant herd. What we had hoped was we would have a repeat of what had happened some years before, when Swami had taken a group of devotees to the Mysore forest. Maybe all you know that story, do you? No? Well, they went into drove around the forest, then they went into a clearing, and the car stopped. And Swami got out of the car and walked some distance in front of the car, and the devotees also got out and walked in front of the car. Swami went a little further away. Nobody follows him too closely. He stays some distance away from him. And so, no sooner had that happened than there was a trumpeting at the edge of the forest. And a great big bull elephant stepped out of the forest, trumpeting. Well, the devotees all turned and rushed back to the car. And Swami looked at them and said, what? You're going to leave Swami here all alone? And then, out of the forest came this giant tusker right up towards Swami. He reached Swami, and down he goes on his knees and touches his head to Swami's feet. Then gets up and goes back into the forest, and the herd disappears. So we had hoped for a replay of that. But we couldn't find any elephants whatsoever. So then, driving around, Swami selected the place where Mahashivaratri would be celebrated, where he would do it. We saw a dry stream under a bridge, and Swami said, we'll stop here. This is where we'll have it. So then we went back to the compound and came back about 6:30 for the Mahashivaratri ceremony. We got out of the car, walking down the bank to the dry river. And as we passed some bushes, Swami reached over and broke off two little twigs. And he put them like that and said, well, what's that, Hislop? So I said, well, it's a cross, Swami. So then he takes the two twigs and puts them in his hand like that and blew several really quite long, delayed breaths into his fists. Then he opened his hand and handed me the crucifix. Well, I didn't know what to say. And I noticed a hole at the top of the crucifix. And so I said, well, Swami, what's that hole? And Swami said, well, the cross was hung on a peg. It's not as history says. The cross was hung on a peg. And it was through this hole that it was pegged to a post. So then we went on down to the river bottom, and we found that as we were sitting on the sand, we were sitting on bones, human bones. And we found it was a place where they burned bodies. And the people said, well, this is quite appropriate for Shiva. I didn't know what they meant when they said that, but later on I learned that that is part of the Indian tradition. And so we sat there. Then Swami sang some bhajans, and he then brought out the lingam and passed around and showed it to every one of us and put it on the table in front of him. And then he reached up and pulled out a vase out of the air, which was filled with amrit. Then he reached up and pulled a spoon out of the air. And then walked around and gave each of us a spoon of the amrit. Then, when I got back to the United States with the crucifix, Mrs. Cowan, you know who Mrs. Cowan is? Mrs. Cowan, an old-time devotee, she's dead now. She had the first Satyasai bookstore in Tustin, California, and used to go there all the time with Mr. Cowan. Maybe I'll have time later on to tell you the story, or maybe this afternoon, the story of the resurrection of Mr. Cowan. And so Mrs. Cowan wanted pictures of the crucifix to add to her inventory in the store. And so I said, well, it would have to be with Swami's permission. So somehow she got Swami's permission. And so a professional photographer who was a devotee, we were living in Mexico, my wife and I. In fact, that is our home for the last 20 years in Mexico. We live in a big house on a hill overlooking the ocean and the islands out in the ocean. And behind us are the mountains of Mexico, a beautiful place. And so he took the photographs, and then he came back a couple of weeks later with the pictures. He did the pictures. We were all sitting around the table admiring the pictures. Now, it was a clear Mexican sky, not a cloud in the sky, just completely still. And suddenly, as we were staring at the pictures and thinking of Swami, there was a sudden burst of thunder, a loud burst of thunder, and a big wind came. We have big French windows to look out on the ocean. Blew open the French windows and banged the doors and blew all the curtains in the house back and forth. And so everybody was puzzled. And they said, what is that? How could that be? And then my wife said, oh, it's in the Bible. So then she went and got the Bible and found the appropriate passage where the winds had come into the temple and had rent the curtains of the temple. And so then another time a chap came down from Northern California and wanted to see the crucifix. So we showed him the crucifix. And as we were showing him the crucifix, there was like an earthquake. The whole house shook. And so then Fanabunda wanted to put the crucifix in his book, Vision of Divinity, I think it's called. And so I wrote him the story about the crucifix, how we'd had this tremendous wind blowing the doors and rending the curtains of the house, and how there'd been an earthquake, and the other chap was looking at it. And whenever Swami goes to Bombay, he usually stops at the house of Fanabunda and visits Fanabunda and his wife and their two children. And this time, there happened to be laying beside Fanabunda's typewriter, he was working on his book, this letter that I had written, Fanabunda. And Swami picked it up and read it. And Fanabunda asked him, well, Swami, is that correct? And Swami said, oh, yes, that's correct. That's correct. That's exactly what happened. It was the recapitulation of the death of Christ. And then I went down, they asked me to go down to Latin America, to El Salvador, to talk to the people there. And at the home of the ghost, or the host rather, not the ghost, the Holy Ghost was about to come, so that's why I got that mixed up. And all the Salvadorian people were in this great big house of the head devotee, and the crucifix, I'd taken it down, was on the table. And suddenly, it was a bright, shiny day there. Suddenly, a tremendous thunder, and it poured rain, and the wind blew open his windows. Same thing happened exactly as it did in our house in Mexico. So it's a very powerful thing, that crucifix. I'm sorry I couldn't bring it to show to you, but it's so fragile that I'm afraid to carry it around.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And that was a narration by Dr. Hislop himself. Definitely, we couldn't have narrated it as well and so beautifully and graphically described by him. In fact, he would say that invariably, wherever he would go to speak, they would ask him to narrate this incident. And I think this was also recorded in some Sai center in the United States. And the beauty of his interaction with Swami is many, many times he had this opportunity of traveling with Swami in Swami's car, and that is where he learned a lot, and he had this opportunity to listen from Swami many things. The interactions that Swami would have with other devotees that he was witness to, I think all of that becomes part of many of the talks that he gives. In fact, there are about 10 of Dr. Hislop's talks on our website itself, if anybody's interested. They're all very interesting, and understandably, actually, much of the content of his talks are Swami's message. He is literally forced to speak some experiences here and there, and that's how he, you know, even in this talk, the entire talk, he says this. After the end of this, yeah, these were the two incidents they asked me to narrate. I've narrated it. I'm done with it. Now let's go to Swami's message.
You know, the kind of things that he has seen, once when he was with Swami at Bombay at Dharmakshetra, they were standing by a table, Hislop and a few others, and suddenly Hislop felt his hand getting wet, and he noticed that there was water oozing out from a box nearby, and in that box were saris. So he actually asked Swami, what was this? Swami, these saris are wet. And Swami had said, no, these are saris that are weeping. Apparently, Swami had ordered for 100 saris to be distributed to all the female workers who were involved in the Anantapur College construction. And as Swami distributed, he had rejected 4 of them. And Swami said, they are weeping because I have rejected them. And Hislop was really amazed. And Hislop said, Swami, do inanimate objects like this have feelings? Because, you know, Hislop tells Swami that, Swami, I have been standing here for the last half an hour. And, you know, I'm sure nobody has spilled any water or anything like that, because that is the reason why I was so amazed and I asked you about it. Otherwise, why should I? Because I have been here for half an hour, there's not a drop of water anywhere that has come close, but suddenly water is coming out of this box. It's almost like somebody opened up a bottle of water, exploded inside the box. It's like that. And interestingly, you know, when Swami shows the saris also, it's not like the saris are fully drenched. They are all, you know, shedding tears at the edges. It's like that, you know, at the edges only. And interestingly, a few months later, when Swami was delivering a discourse at Prashantinilayam, Swami referred to this episode. And that is when Swami narrated the incident of the Govardhana Hill for the first time. You know, I think we have used it in our satsang sometime before. But when the bridge was being built, a human chain was formed, not a human chain, a monkey chain was formed from the southernmost tip of India till the northern parts where all these rocks and mountains were available, from the Himalayas. So these mountains were being plucked by these Vanarasena members, the members of the monkey army, and they were being passed on in this chain till they were brought to the southernmost point, and the bridge was being built with these rocks. Suddenly, once the bridge was built, it was said that it's enough. Now, no, we don't need any more rocks and mountains, and the message was conveyed through the belt. And therefore, all the monkeys dropped all the hills, boulders, rocks, whatever they were carrying at that spot itself. And one such hillock that was dropped was weeping with sorrow that, you know, I got this chance to participate in the Lord's mission, but at the last minute I've been rejected. That is when Rama blesses the hillock, saying that I will bless you when I come again next time. And that is the Govardhana hill which Lord Krishna picked on his little finger, which we discussed during the Bhagavata Vahini satsang that we recently concluded. So Swami narrated this in the discourse and said that that is how the saris were weeping, because everything has consciousness, everything has that love, and therefore they respond to love, either the presence or the absence of it. And that was another phenomenal incident that was witnessed and documented by Dr. John Hislop.
I think it is there in this book itself. It will come later where he writes about that conversation. Mm. In fact, because when he asks Swami about that, Swami tells him the story there to him, that this happened even during Rama's time, and Swami narrates this entire story. And he says how Govardhana Giri cried. And of course, as you said, in 1971, in one of the discourses, Swami narrates that whole incident of, you know, how Hislop asked that question and Swami explained it to him. Mm-hmm. But the beauty of that conversation, you know, invariably every experience will have a punch. And we remember that incident with that punchline, right? And the one with this incident is, when Swami narrated this incident, Hislop was overwhelmed and he said, Swami, this is so brilliant. And he asked Swami, that Swami, this is the reenactment of what happened in the Treta Yuga. You know, what happened in the Treta Yuga, it's happening again here.
It's like Krishna's times.
He said, it's the same thing being reenacted here. And Swami told, it's not only the same drama, sir, it is the same Rama too, Swami said.
Wow.
It's not the same incident happening, it is the same Rama who is, you know, who is at the center of this incident happening again. And yeah, that was, as you said, one of the beautiful and memorable incidents which involves him.
Another that he records is, you know, something amazing where he says that in Mexico, he is all in that talk we heard, how he's saying that he has a huge house on top of a hill in Mexico overseeing the ocean. And they had a garden and they had a gardener who was very dutiful in his job, but had an addiction to alcohol. So there was a time when his child was very sick, and he was worried about the child, and definitely Dr. John Hislop and his wife helped him. When they were in India during the interview, without them mentioning anything, Swami waved his palm, created a gold chain with a pendant, gave it to them and said, this is for your gardener. And, you know, Dr. John Hislop was so thrilled that, you know that this is the omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent being in front of you, but when that is displayed, you are so thrilled. And he was so thrilled, and he said, yes, Swami, he's a good man. Swami said, no, not a good man, he drinks too much, he has got bad habits. That is what Swami said, and that was even more thrilling. And that was one incident that happened. Another incident that happened is, Swami wanted to send prasadam for Mr. and Mrs. Cowan, and he held out his hand. And he told Hislop to hold out his hand so that he can pass on the prasadam. And as Hislop held out his hand, he saw that there was some kind of a liquid on Swami's hand, and he was wondering how is he going to carry this liquid. But as Swami held his hand and gently shook it, it solidified, it crystallized. And when Swami pulled into his hand, it was a soft crystal which was hardening by the moment. It was not hot, it was not warm. It was normal room temperature, but it was something soft which was hardening. And he says, finally, when I gave it to the Covens, it was sugar candy. Mm-hmm. So these are some amazing experiences that he has had. Swami created for the first time ever, Swami created a ring with Premasai on it for Hislop only. And then there's another phenomenal incident that he narrates about, like when he's sitting in the car. He's sitting in the front seat. In the back seat, there is Swami and two other people. One of them is, I think, the father of Dr. Jayalakshmi Gopinath.
Vittal Rao.
Yes, Mr. Vittal Rao, Keshav Vittal. They're sitting there, and he says that he was turning around, craning his neck all the while, because he wanted to see what Swami is doing, talking, what he's talking, hearing, being part of that conversation. And in a moment, suddenly Swami changes color. Swami becomes blue. And his face changes shape. He's looking very beautiful, very dark complexion. It's an entirely different look that Swami is having. And Hislop is unable to believe his eyes. He just continues to stare. He's not able to even blink his eyes. And he's wondering, how is it that the people next to Swami are not noticing? And when this goes on for 3-4 minutes, it is then that Mr. Vittal Rao tells Hislop, what happened? Why are you staring at Swami like that? Hislop is The moment this question is asked, Hislop sees Swami sitting there again. So he instantly asks Swami, Swami, what was that blue? Swami said, blue is the color of something that is very, very deep. That was that blue, Swami told him. And, you know, it was a question and answer that the other occupants of the car didn't understand. But later on, Swami did indeed, you know, in one interview where Swami had called a gentleman from Assam. There, when Swami was talking about Krishna, Swami had called in Hislop also for that interview. Swami pointed out and said that he has seen Krishna. He has seen Krishna, Swami told. And when that gentleman from Assam was very amazed and he said, oh, wonderful. And Swami said, not the Krishna that you see in drawings. He has seen Krishna as he actually looked, as he was actually. And that is what confirmed to Hislop that what he was thinking was indeed true. So that is the sort of personality, that is the sort of individual that Hislop was, a true jignyasu, a person who wanted to ask questions, not for the sake of asking questions, but because there was some deep rooted dissatisfaction and unrest within him. In order to clear that unrest, he has asked all these questions. And I think as we hear these answers, because these are the words of the avatar, deep rooted dissatisfaction and unrest within us also will begin to dissolve.
Talking about all these incidents, I think probably it's appropriate to conclude with probably his first interaction with Swami. You know, we spoke about how he was drawn to Swami, that one word of that friend of his which brought him to Swami, but we did not mention that first interview or the first interaction that he had with Swami, which is itself very, very profound. Because clearly he is not a person who has come seeking Swami's omniscience or Swami's omnipotence in the form of some materialization. He has come seeking something, and the only way Swami could probably confirm to him that he has come to the right place is give him an experience which was completely internal. And in fact, this is something which he often narrates. I heard in another talk too, where they ask him, how did he get convinced that, you know, Swami was divine? Because he has been around, so visited so many places, you know, he's been a aspirant in his own way, and he finally comes to Swami, and he narrates that incident of that first interview, where he says, you know, I think the interview is not in Swami's interview room. It is actually in some devotee's house, maybe in one of those cottages in old Vrindavan. I think that's where Swami comes and meets them. And he says the moment Swami walks in, I mean, the description is so beautiful. He says, Swami is so calm. The way Swami gets up, Swami stands, Swami walks, there is a fluidity which is not human. He says, at the same time, Swami is not, removed or dull or in that sense, somebody who is so drawn detached within and detached. No, he says, the eyes are so cheerful, the eyes are so deep, there's a twinkle and, you know, there is mischief in the eye. And he says, but still there is something different. And he tells that even as Swami is sitting in his presence, he finds some kind of warmth in his heart which he has never felt before. Something is stirring within, and he says that experience is completely alien to him. And he says that that's the stirring of the feeling of love that he felt. And it was not because Swami said something which was miraculous or did something which was so stunning that he was drawn to Swami, but he said that this feeling of love which I felt in my heart, I felt that only divinity, in divinity's presence, you could have such an experience. And in fact, in the book, The Conversations, the first paragraph that he writes in the dedication section is so beautiful, because it combines this first experience that he has of feeling Swami's love and that quest which has always been taking him from place to place, that, you know, that spiritual aspiration which was there. I'll just read out those three lines which he writes in that first paragraph. He says, this work is submitted at the lotus feet of Sri Satyasai, who is as a lighthouse to me, buffeted by gales of ignorance and tossed here and there amidst the stormy shoals of my life. The signal from light is, abandon the stormy shallows for the deep, for therein is to be found calm and bliss everlasting, and liberation from the snarl of birth and death. Indeed, Sri Satyasai declares that love is the deep, and that love itself is God. So he says, on one hand, the answers are to be found in the depths. You have to leave the shallows of your comfort zone and come into the deep in search of the answers. And that deep is not something which is an intellectual exercise. And he says that deep is love itself, and that love itself is God.
That is the experience. You know, it's so amazing because, as you said, it is not anything that Swami said or did. It's just the presence. Hislop finds himself melting away, and he finds a kind of fulfillment within him. He feels himself filling up, you know, he's melting and he's filling up at the same time. And all that he has searched for so many decades so far, he's finding a culmination in just being in the presence of Swami. In fact, there's a statement that he writes. He says that it would require an extremely negative being to be able to be in Swami's presence and feel anything else but positivity and love. That is how he writes. He says it's just not possible for any ordinary person to come in Bhagwan's presence and not feel love and positivity. And he says that just being in the presence, I felt this. And no wonder that a person who, without thinking for a moment longer, after having had his conviction that he's not able to experience anything, he went and he just resigned. Such a kind of being, in the very first moment, it was equally drastic and dramatic. Just like for 2 decades he has done something and in just one moment he resigned and left all that. Here in just one moment he has not had anything else. In that one moment he decided that from now on every decade of my life is for Swami. And I think from what we have heard from Dr. Samuel Sandwise, even till his last days, when he was breathing his last, he remained with that same conviction, loyalty and love for Swami.
And I think as we go through this book, I mean, of course, the conversations are very, very profound. The idea is to dwell deep into Swami's words. But I think in between, we will, if we come across some beautiful stories where Swami has given some beautiful experiences to Hislop, because as we said, it's not just about the miraculous aspect to these miracles, but when given to a person who is so deep and who is looking for something so deep, I think his understanding of that incident also will be very, very profound. And so we'll try and intersperse the study of this particular work with some of the experiences that he's had. But it's promising to be a very, very beautiful journey, because in many of our other satsangs too, when we're trying to see what is Swami's explanation for some things or what does Swami expect of us in certain aspects, we do find ourselves invariably meandering towards conversations with Sai, and some of these conversations which are very, very popular even on the other shows like Shravanam Mananam and Outside Inside, you would have heard references being made constantly to some of these things. So it's going to be a beautiful journey for us, because it's we've seen that we have read Ramakatha Rasavani so many times, we've read Bhagatvani so many times, but when we take it up for afternoon satsang, we tend to read it really probably the way we should be reading it. So we are very excited about taking up this book for a new series on afternoon satsang.
So with that, dear listeners, we will bring the curtains down on this curtain raiser. We hope that we have aroused the same excitement and enthusiasm in all of you. If not, then it is entirely our fault, because this book is simply fascinating and phenomenal. If you are having any doubts, lay your hands on the book and start going it by yourself. You need not depend on the afternoon satsang for that. But it would be nice if you join us in our satsang and contribute your thoughts, your feelings, your ideas, your understanding, because it will enrich our satsang. You can, as always, write to us at listener@radiosai.org. Both Prem and me, I will be looking forward for these mails. We'll read through. We'll try to present as much of that in our future satsangs. On that note, we would like to offer this at the lotus feet of our beloved Swami. And we will leave you with this song, on the other side of which you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.